welcome back to the second half of this episode of Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is our first episode and one I've titled Prelude, where we are exploring musical compositions that were intended to be a prelude or an introduction to a greater length work. And also this episode itself is serving as a prelude to the entire show, where I'm showing how we will approach this particular show on this radio station. I'm hoping to answer some fundamental questions about music, about its origins, about its importance. We're talking right now about the importance of music. How important is music, after all? Toward the end of our first half, we were discussing that particular question. We were talking about how centuries ago, music was considered far more important than it is today. It was considered a basic part of education. We talked about how the brain loves music, how the mind and the emotions and even the body benefit from music. Also, in our first half, we were talking about the origins of music, or considering what the Bible has to say about the origins of music. Again, separate from any denominational or doctrinal discussion, just looking right at the Bible matter-of-factly and seeing what it has to say about music back in the earliest points of creation. And we also see from that, related back to this question about how important is music, we see from that how important music was considered by God for the first humans, for the first garden where he put the first humans. And we see how important music was to him and to his plan for mankind. We see how important music is even in his angelic creation. We can see throughout history, as we will see, how important music is to God and his nation and his church and all the work that he does, as is documented in the Bible. It's there for anyone to see. So if you believe in the Bible, that adds certainly a greater importance to music than just the physical benefits, or maybe the emotional and mental benefits that music could bring as well. There's a spiritual benefit to it, as the Bible points out. Just by way of review, we started this discussion about how important is music by reading a quote from the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who said back in August of 2010, "It's better that our dear youth spend their valuable time in learning science and essential and useful skills." And he was, in that quote, denouncing all forms of music as not compatible, he said, not compatible with the highest values of the sacred regime of the Islamic Republic. Now, those comments may come across as offensive or disagreeable to someone in the West who champions either music or freedom or both. But as off-base as those comments may seem about music, the Ayatollah is in famous company, particularly among two thinkers who shaped the modern education system as we know it today, or I might add the musically handicapped modern education system that we know today, Sigmund Freud and Charles Darwin. Not only was music simply not important to these men, there appeared to be some great chasm between them and this illustrious element of humanity. In all his writings, Freud mentioned his personal connection to music only once. This is what he said: "I am almost incapable of obtaining any pleasure from music," he was saying. Continuing with the quote, "Some rationalistic or perhaps analytic turn of mind in me rebels against being moved by a thing without knowing why I am thus affected and what it is that affects me." And that's the end of the quote. Darwin was similarly unmoved by it. He said, "Formerly music gave me very intense delight, but now I have almost lost my taste for music," he wrote. My mind seems to have become a sort of machine for grinding general laws out of large collections of fact. The loss of these tastes is a loss of happiness and may possibly be injurious to the intellect and more probably to the moral character by enfeebling the emotional part of our nature. He acknowledged that he was missing out on something and that it may well have been injurious. Now, hopefully this program will show you what the Ayatollah and Darwin and Freud were missing out on. It will show you the incredible value and importance of music to humanity's existence, to humanity's enrichment. That's what the title of this show even is about, Music for Life. Yes, I'm playing music that I think enriches our lives physically, and I do believe music should be permanent in each human's life, that they should be involved in music for life, in the sense of for the rest of their lives. But I do believe there's a spiritual component, and that music is part of that spiritual component, that music enhances our connection to the spiritual, that it's not just music for this life, but that it's music for life, music that points us toward a longer life, a more enriching life, and even eternal life. Dr. Oliver Sacks wrote that music is part of being human, and there is no human culture in which it is not highly developed and esteemed. Its very ubiquity may cause it to be trivialized in daily life. We switch on a radio, switch it off, hum a tune, tap our feet, find the words of an old song going through our minds, and think nothing of it, he wrote. Now, how important is music? So important, in fact, that ironically, it can become trivialized by its very saturation of our lives. Now, hopefully we will never let that familiarity breed such contempt that we forget its impact on our existence, how intrinsic it is to the world created around us, and how vital it is to the instruction and development and maturation of our children. You're listening to Music for Life. This is our first episode, titled Prelude. Let's have another musical example. This is another example of an overture. Now, as I said before, an overture was usually a movement, an instrumental movement, that preceded a larger grouping of pieces, usually a stage production, a vocal work, but the overture was an instrumental work. Sometimes an overture, though, was written to stand alone, to be singular. When Felix Mendelssohn wrote his overture to A Midsummer Night's Dream, certainly that became an overture to a greater number of movements later, when the King of Prussia asked him to write incidental music for the entire Shakespearean play. But when he was 17 and just writing this singular, independent orchestral movement, he was not considering it to be the prelude or the introduction to anything greater. In this case, this overture was a singular, independent work, and it was intended to embody the entire play, the entire spirit of Shakespeare's play. Other overtures in the repertoire come to mind, the most famous probably being the 1812 overture. That's not an overture to an opera or anything like that. It's an independent piece that embodies a time period in Russian history. And you can find several other examples in music of overtures that are not overtures to anything, but independent instrumental works. Prokofiev's Overture on Hebrew Themes, an interesting and beautiful piece for clarinet, string quartet, and piano. And George Gershwin's Cuban Overture, which is also a fun orchestral piece. So those are just a couple of examples. But let's listen to this beautiful and stirring overture to A Midsummer Night's Dream by Felix Mendelssohn.
Thank you.
That was Felix Mendelssohn's Overture to A Midsummer Night's Dream. And hopefully on this show, Music for Life, at some point I'll be able to go over some more of those details inside that piece and show you how Mendelssohn was bringing out musically certain aspects of Shakespeare's play. So we were talking about overtures, things that precede longer works. Of course, that was an overture that was originally intended to stand alone as an independent piece of music and embody the entire spirit of the play. And so even though this episode is titled Prelude, and it is intended to be a prelude, a setup for all the remaining episodes, this episode itself is answering some very fundamental, basic questions that need to be answered just independently of themselves about the importance of music, the origins of music, and now the importance of music appreciation. That's our third question today. First, we asked, where did music come from? Secondly, we asked, how important is music? And next, I want to answer a related question. How important is music appreciation? What does it mean to appreciate music or to appreciate quality music? Is appreciation something we should have to learn in the first place? Or should quality music already have an immediate appeal to us? That's the question I want to answer next.
Let's face the music and dance, dance. Let's face the music and dance.
We are recording the show from the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College, and every spring semester here at Armstrong College, I teach a music appreciation course. And it's a 2-hour-a-week course, which is required of every 2-year graduate at Armstrong College. They face it during their last semester before receiving the 2-year diploma that AC offers. Now, I ask them, just as I'm asking on this program, what is the purpose of music appreciation? Why require a class like that? Now, the namesake of our college, Herbert W. Armstrong, he required this of all his students at Ambassador College, which had 3 campuses around the world. Now, that's partly why we require it here. We are patterned after those institutions, but we also see the great value and benefit in music appreciation. And what is that benefit? Why would he and why would we require that of those receiving this education? In other words, why would you listen to this program? What's the importance of learning how to appreciate music? Well, Mr. Armstrong said a lot about modern education, and he said it was perpetuating false values. On the whole, it was teaching distorted history and warped psychology and perverted arts and sciences. That's what he wrote in his book, The Wonderful World Tomorrow. And in stating the purpose of Ambassador College just 3 years into its existence, he said the school's well-rounded education was development of personality, ability to express oneself, instilling character, and training in true culture. And in the second volume of his autobiography, he emphasized that one of the aspects of the school's education was true culture. When referring to the college, he commonly used phrases like cultural development, cultural advantages, and cultural surroundings. Culture was an important part of that education. It's an important part, really, of our existence as human beings. Now, culture, according to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, refers to enlightenment and excellence of taste acquired by intellectual and aesthetic training. Yes, culture requires training. Appreciation requires training. It takes effort to be cultured. That means education. Appreciation of the finer things is utterly impossible without education. One can't appreciate certain foods or beverages or art on a deep level without being educated first. Now, some things in life can be enjoyed with little effort, but there is a difference between enjoyment and appreciation. I remind my students of that all the time in music appreciation. There's a difference between enjoying and appreciating something. You can appreciate the value of something and not really enjoy it. You can appreciate the value of eating your vegetables and maybe not enjoy those vegetables. Appreciation, though, can lead to enjoyment. And in the realm of music, it often does. Now, why should music appreciation take such training, such effort? I believe it is because we live in the midst of a cultural crisis here in Western civilization, and there are values that need to be recaptured. I do believe at one time learning to appreciate music, great quality music, would not have taken as much effort as it does today. So to answer our question, how important is music appreciation? It is particularly important in our age today, where we have become so accustomed to affluence and ease. Even our work tends to be easy, and we can be numbed to believe that everything should come easy, even our culture. That if it takes effort and education to appreciate something, then we probably would move on to something easier. That would be our knee-jerk reaction, which usually would mean something of lesser quality. And then true culture, by its very definition, can die. So music appreciation, learning to appreciate quality music, is important. And it is something that we should consider here at the beginning of this musical journey here on this program, Music for Life. Music appreciation requires us to exercise one of our five physical senses, a sense that can give us great pleasure, and a sense that actually goes far beyond just hearing. What we hear can have a deep mental and emotional impact on us, just like what we taste in terms of our food can have a deep, long-lasting physical impact on our general health. The Bible condones and exhorts its readers to have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. That's what Hebrews 5:14 says. And the Greek words inspired there about having the senses exercised implies a vigorous athletic training. And the idea of discerning good and evil, in the Greek, that word discern means judicial estimation. The Bible encourages its readers to judge what's being presented to their senses, to judge all the evidence and the facts and the angles and the considerations, and then make a decision based on that training and that evidence, what is going into your senses, whether it's good or evil. The Bible certainly indicates that God wants us to exercise our five physical senses, to learn what the true values for the enjoyment of those senses are. And one of those senses is hearing, and one of the ways we exercise our hearing sense is in the appreciation of quality music. There is plenty to appreciate about man's artistic output through the ages, in spite of whatever creed or beliefs he or she espoused. Human beings have been producing quality art for thousands of years. There certainly is value in various art forms, various styles of music. The Apostle Paul, for example, he was familiar with and quoted the poetic artistry of the pagan Greek writers. You can see that in Acts 17, verse 28. He was a cultured individual. He knew literature. So there is value to be found. There are things that we can appreciate. Particularly, we should appreciate that which is an expression of the spirit in man, that which reflects his incredible human potential and godlike creative talents. So we are answering the question here on Music for Life: how important is music appreciation? And what kind of music should we learn to appreciate? And why do we have to learn to appreciate it? Shouldn't music, if it's good and right, have an immediate appeal? Doesn't having to learn about how to appreciate music defeat the whole purpose of music? These questions certainly accompany the question, how important is music appreciation? Well, now consider, if you were to judge the health benefits or the health factors of a food based purely on whether it tasted good, well, you would think a whole lot of things are healthy, maybe the healthiest thing ever, and you wouldn't really be that healthy for eating it because you just relied on the immediate taste. The same applies to the musical diet, if you will. We can't base our judicial estimation purely on whether it sounds good or whether we immediately like it. Many things in this world have an immediate appeal, and really, lower quality music would be among those things. Here's a quote I found interesting from the Plain Truth magazine, November 1965. It says, inferior music is what it calls it. Inferior music often has an immediate appeal, but this appeal is usually based on something trite. It soon wears off. This is why 300 new rock and roll records are produced each week. On the other hand, it requires time and effort to develop an appreciation of good classical music, for example. This is because it is more challenging. There is more to listen to. Quality music also has a lasting appeal. Once you have learned to enjoy it, you don't tire of it easily. The more you hear it, the more you enjoy it. And that's the end of the quote. And certainly there are types of music that you can listen to that sound great right away, and then the more you listen to it, the more you tire of it. And then there is some music that's written. Somehow the composers have done something where the more you listen to it, the more you notice about it, the deeper you appreciate it, the deeper you love it. That is certainly an indication of quality music, and certainly is an argument for the time that it takes, and the effort that it takes, and the education that it takes to develop that appreciation. Yes, effort and time are required to appreciate an art form that is known for its length. Aside from a few short pieces, classical music is generally long and daunting for those accustomed to our modern, fast-paced, abbreviation-happy society. Now, at one time, this kind of music may have had more immediate appeal, but with the decline in our culture, the death of true culture, some might argue, we need to work hard to restore this kind of appreciation and culture into our lives. That article from The Plain Truth from November 1965 said, high quality is generally classical music's strong point. It has been composed by the best musicians of each age and has stood the test of time. It is usually well performed and heard in pleasing surroundings. And something that my music history teacher in college always stressed with us was that when you listen to music that has survived for hundreds of years, you have to keep in mind that you are not judging this music, but the music is judging you. Because it's survived. It's been around. We haven't been around as long as this music. And we need to find out why it has survived this long and what is the value and the quality in this music. Now, please understand that when I talk about quality music, I'm not automatically referring to classical music only. Music is generally categorized into three traditions: fine art, or what some people call concert music, and then popular music, music intended for the masses or mass entertainment or mass appeal, and folk, music of folk life. And these categories can cause some to assume that one tradition is more quality than another, but there is quality music in all three traditions. Did you know that even the Bible discusses all three traditions? There were highly trained temple musicians who performed what we might call concert music or fine art music. King David, as a shepherd boy, also wrote what we might consider folk music. And Jesus Christ referred to music intended to be danced to at social occasions, our popular music, we could say. Now, in music appreciation class at Armstrong College, we could spend many a semester on each tradition and discuss how to appreciate it. Instead, we focus on how to appreciate the highest quality music that exists in the fine art or classical tradition. Why? Well, because this music takes the most education and effort to appreciate and enjoy. And it takes more time than teaching an appreciation of, say, certain types of popular or folk music. And I believe if you can learn to understand and appreciate and eventually enjoy fine art music, then you can certainly take that education and apply it to these other realms of music and learn how to appreciate the quality music that exists in these other traditions. Now, finally, as we consider how important is music education, before we wrap up this question, I'd like to address those who may be a little trepidatious about exploring classical music. We may have some preconceived ideas or some prejudices toward classical music. In our music appreciation class, I challenge our students to consider what might be holding them back from appreciating classical music, what those prejudices might be. And in most cases, I believe they have to do with two things. Number one, fear of what appreciation and even enjoyment of fine art music will do to their current tastes. And number two, not knowing what to expect when listening. First, consider your favorite flavor of ice cream, I tell them. If a new flavor comes along, do you never try it simply because you're afraid? Well, if I like this one, I can't still like my favorite flavor anymore. Of course not. If you like mint chocolate chip ice cream, trying a new flavor doesn't mean you have to reject mint chocolate chip as your favorite. The same is true of music. If you have a certain taste in music right now, it doesn't mean you have to let that go necessarily, or that you have to exclude that to enjoy and appreciate classical music. Secondly, I tell them that some of their prejudices or preconceived notions about classical music could be rooted in not knowing what to expect from the music. And I encourage them to think of the different styles of music as different sports. You know, if you liked baseball but didn't like basketball just because basketball didn't have astroturf and dugouts and bases and wooden bats, well, that wouldn't be fair to basketball, would it? You'd be judging basketball by the rules of baseball, but it has its own set of rules. It has its own set of objectives, strategies, and team sizes even that can be equally exciting. And even if you like one sport over another, once you learn all the aspects of a game, you should at least be able to appreciate it. Maybe you don't enjoy that particular game as much, but knowing the rules, knowing the objectives and the strategies and some of the players, some of the history maybe, you start to appreciate that sport. That's how I like to approach music appreciation. That if you're judging classical music by the rules of modern pop, country, or jazz, then classical music will fail, just as basketball will fail as a sport if you judge it by the rules of baseball. So the student's job in music appreciation is to learn the rules of the game. And that really leads to our next fundamental question, our fourth question in this program, answering five fundamental questions about music. The fourth question being, how should we approach music appreciation? Or what is the best way to go about learning how to appreciate music? And I think if we take this metaphor of using different sports and understanding the rules and strategies and objectives of those sports in order to appreciate those games, we can take that approach into music. Look at it as a sport with strategies and objectives, major players, historical context. Learn all those things, and then we can understand how best to appreciate music. The second lecture I give in my music appreciation class here at Herbert W. Armstrong College is called The Rules of the Game. It's about knowing what to expect. And I'll give you a brief overview of what I cover in that lecture to help answer our question, how should we approach music appreciation? And I approach it, as I said, like learning the rules of a game or learning the strategies of a sport, the objectives. Now, to learn these rules, we do have to know a certain vocabulary, and we'll talk about that. We also have to know, how should we listen to this music? What should we be thinking about? What should we be listening for? Now, I propose that when we listen to music, we're listening to two things mainly. And I mean this when we listen to any kind of music, that we're listening to form and medium. Form referring to how the song is structured. Say you're hearing a pop song and you hear verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, repeat and fade. And we're listening to the medium, and the medium refers to what is making the music. What instruments do we hear? What timbres do we hear? Okay, we hear a singer, or we hear backup singers, or we hear guitars or drums. So when it comes to classical music, knowing what to expect, knowing the rules of the game, we have to learn, well, what do we expect in terms of form? Now, classical music is longer in many cases, but what is the format? What do we expect to happen after this section? And then what do we expect to happen after this section? So that form is an integral part of what to expect or what the rules of the game are for classical music. And then we also consider medium in classical music. What do we expect to hear from this piece? What instruments do we expect to hear? And so we listen for that as well, and we know what to expect. There are three other things that we should listen for when listening to classical music, things that help us know what to expect. Those are genre, and the genre refers to what type of piece is it? Is it a sonata? Is it a concerto? Is it an aria? In classical music, that links closely with the medium, or what's making the music, what instruments are being employed. The second thing of these three other things to listen to is texture. And this refers to how all the parts of a piece of music fit together. Some music is just one melody sung in unison, what's called a monophonic texture. Now, this isn't used very commonly anymore, but it was very common in the Middle Ages, espoused by Gregorian chant. Some pieces have different voices or instrumental parts performing several different things at the same time. That's called a polyphonic texture. That occurs a lot in classical music. And then some music has a distinct melody, one melodic line, but that is supported by other notes, other harmonies, and that's called a homophonic texture. And that's probably the most common texture that we hear in pop music in particular, but also is used very commonly in classical music as well. And then the third thing that we listen for in these three other things to listen to with classical music, in knowing what to expect, is the style period. When was the music composed? Where was it composed? What was the style or the climate of the society when it was being composed? There's a Turkish proverb that says, as the music is, so are the people of the country. Now, in terms of geography, we will be camping out in Western Europe a fair bit, talking about music produced and composed there, but also we will venture into Russia and Asia and South America and North America. Michael Walsh wrote a book called Who's Afraid of Classical Music? And in it, he said, true, the great bulk of classical music was composed by white Western Europeans, but then white Western Europeans invented English too, a language that is now spoken as a primary tongue in such disparate countries and continents as the United States, Australia, India, and Liberia, and which has become the world's lingua franca in trade and commerce. So it is with classical music, he writes. Like English, it has spread across the world, taking root in the most ostensibly foreign of climes. The charge that classical music is an elitist urban entertainment suited only to the white moneyed class is hereby rejected. So classical music is for everyone. So hopefully that gives a brief answer to the question, how should we approach music appreciation? You're listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone, And the title of this episode is Prelude, because we are discussing preludes, overtures, and introductions, musical pieces that are intended to introduce greater and longer works, just as this episode is a prelude to all the episodes that will follow for this program. I want to play you an example now. I've already played you an example of an overture that actually wasn't meant to introduce anything but stood alone as an independent work. That also was true of preludes. Sometimes a composer would write a prelude. It usually sounded like a short, improvisatory type of piece. And Chopin, Frédéric Chopin, wrote a series of dozens of preludes, and I want to play you one of those today. Here's a prelude by Frédéric Chopin. It's not a prelude to anything. It's just a standalone, independent, singular piece of music. Very short as well. Since we've been talking about how long classical music can be, here's a short example. Yuliana Avdiva just played Chopin's Prelude in A Major, Opus 28, Number 7. You are listening to Music for Life. We're wrapping our discussion up now in our episode called Prelude, where we're introducing this program to you. Today we have discussed music's origins, music's importance to human existence. We've showed the importance of having an educated appreciation for music and the best way to go about that education. Finally, let's briefly discuss our final question. How will this program be formatted? How will we approach our discussions of music history and appreciation in this format, in this radio program? Our main discussion, every episode, will be recent music history, the last 250, 300 years. Usually, we will intersperse this discussion with three unique segments. These segments will explore each episode's theme further. In our segment called Sounds of Scripture, we will survey the Bible's many references to music and show the importance of music in biblical worship and in biblical record. In a segment titled Classroom Corner, we will explore different methods and curricula for introducing young people to music. And in the segment Backstage Banter, we will interview performers on the concert circuit today for their perspectives on music. We will also have special episodes that break this format occasionally. The week before an event at Armstrong Auditorium that appears on the Armstrong International Cultural Foundation's Performing Arts Series, I want to introduce you to the artist and the program preparing you for that concert. Finally, each episode will end with what I term musical dessert, where we will hear an example from maybe the popular or folk tradition or something maybe just a little lighter fare as relates to the episode's main theme to end our show. Before I get to this dessert, I want to remind you that you can follow us on Twitter at MusicForLifePCG. For our last selection of the program today, we will hear an overture. This is called The Farewell Overture. It's written by a modern composer, Jean Belmont. It's an overture, but she's taken many, many ways of saying goodbye and put them all into one choir piece. This is performed by the University Singers of the University of Missouri Columbia, Dr. David Rail, conductor.
Parting is such sweet sorrow.
You have been listening to Music for Life. From the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.